This week, we put the spotlight on a rebellious city, Barcelona, as we continue our series on Monocle's brand new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. Today, that rebellious streak is in sharp focus with the continuing fight by many for Catalan independence and the stance taken by locals against tourists coming to the city. But from Ildefons Cerdà's innovative city grid, designed to improve quality of life, to the legacy that flowed from the 1992 Olympics, Barcelona is a city that has been made fresh again and again by taking risks and experimenting. Join us over the next 30 minutes as we hear a report on the city from our Spain correspondent, Liam Aldus. That's coming up right now on The Urbanist, so stay tuned.
Barcelona is a city with fire in its belly, rebellious, revolutionary, and reeling for a fight. Revolt is such a regular feature in its history that a contrarian spirit has signed itself into the urban credo. In the 19th century, proletariat passions saw factories razed and ad hoc barricades burnt with such frequency that authorities started to widen streets as a cautionary measure. In 1909, when a royal decree imposed conscription on the working class, the masses responded with a wave of arson attacks against churches and convents, earning the city the nickname La Rosa del Foc, the Rose of Fire. More than a century later, this fiery epithet is still worn as a badge of pride. Barcelona doesn't like being told what to do.
Que somos muchos más la gente desgraciada y la gente que nos quedamos sin casa, sin trabajo, sin dinero, sin hijos porque se van.
But the city also has a time-worn tendency for experimentation. Following a wave of discontent about inequality and grand government plans that were leaving residents behind, activist Ada Colau swept into the mayor's office at the 2015 elections. It was the start of just another chapter in a centuries-old, sometimes messy, story of a city always agitating towards a common goal. And Gerard Pisarello, Barcelona's deputy mayor, adds a new face to this long tradition of upstarts.
On Saturday, grassroots and left-wing activist Ada Colau was sworn in as the mayor of Barcelona. Colau said the victory was thanks to the, quote, hard work of the thousands of people who've shown politics can be done differently.
Ada Colau is the first female mayor of the city, and that was a sort of revolution, because she's not just a female mayor, but she has popular origins. She does not belong to the traditional families that have ruled Barcelona. And it's also my case. I mean, I was born in Argentina. I am the first deputy mayor with Latin American origins. And that has been only possible as a result of this democratic municipalist revolt that happened in the whole Spain, not just Barcelona, but also Madrid, Valencia, Coruña. And that was this municipalist spring in 2015. But that also reflects the history of Barcelona. Barcelona is a rebel city, has always been a rebel city from the 18th century, a very strong working class movement, an anarchist tradition, a feminist tradition also, and that reflects in the current government.
Yeah, it has this reputation as the La Rosa del Foc, no? The Rose of Fire.
Well, I mean, that has been something crucial to understand all the democratic rights that have been conquered in Barcelona in a certain way. I mean, if we have a beautiful city with lot of like public libraries, public spaces, squares, that also has a lot to do with this rebellious tradition. Without democracy, is also conflict. And when neighbors organize themselves, many rights are conquered. But of course, we have to say that Barcelona has also a conservative soul, a bourgeois soul, but it has different souls. The rebellious soul, but also some conservative souls. And we are the product of this mixture of different traditions in the city. When we decided to launch our citizen platform, because most of the members of the current government, we don't belong to professional politics, let's say it was our first time we ran for office. And when we did that, it was because we had the feeling that we were losing the city and that we had to gain it back to the people, for the people. And so fighting against speculation, against gentrification is one of our main objectives right now. And because if we have inequalities growing in our cities, we will see the extreme right, these nationally xenophobic positions growing also. And that will be terrible, not just for Barcelona, but for the whole Europe.
A lot of the comments I've heard from the government is that people don't want Barcelona to become the Benidorm of the north. Is that, do you think the city, if it continued in the direction that it was going a few years ago, would have become a playground for tourists and not much else? Is that what you were trying to kind of put an end to?
Well, Barcelona is a cosmopolitan city. It's an open city. People come from everywhere. Many languages are spoken in Barcelona. And we love having people visiting us because we are all tourists. I mean, we all love to travel. But the issue is how to regulate that, because that cannot become a problem for our neighbors. I mean, and now we have some neighbors where you have like tourist accommodations. 80% of the housing stock is tourist accommodation, and then you don't have house for the neighbors. And that's not good for the city, and it's not good for tourists, because many people come to Barcelona and they say they love the city, and but when you ask them what you don't like about the city, they say too many tourists. So, I mean, we need to regulate that. We don't want to be, I mean, Venice, which is a city that I love, but we don't want to become that. We want to regulate it to make it sustainable. And to make it sustainable, you have to regulate it. And that's common sense for us.
A lot of other cities are facing similar challenges, and a lot of them are looking at Barcelona and wondering what you're going to do to stem the tide. What are the solutions that are on your table?
First of all, we have to decentralize tourism. And we need to protect housing rights. That's basic. As I said before, we are a very rebellious city, but we are also a very creative city. I mean, Barcelona needs to innovate, needs to create. Yes, as you know, Sardà was an utopian socialist, and what he wanted to do when he decided to design the Eixample, which is the main neighborhood of the city, is to have public spaces open to everyone, no? Regardless of their social class. And well, he didn't manage to do exactly what he wanted, because the people that had the money did not agree completely with his project. But it's true that Barcelona has planned its urbanism in a way that allows the city to have many inclusive public spaces. And that's very important, because that's a sort of school of citizenship. If you don't have public spaces open to everyone, the idea of citizenship does not exist. And that's very important in Barcelona. As we do have public spaces, open spaces, the possibilities of having a stronger democracy, is there. What we need is to defend the right to the city. And in order to do that, does that not depend only on the administration and the institutions? That depends mainly on what happens in the street, what people do in their jobs, in the schools. If they fight for the right to the city, we'll have a much better city.
You only have to wander through Barcelona's quaint Gothic quarter to be able to breathe in the air of residents' frustration. Balconies brim with banners adorned with angry anti-tourist slogans as streams of tour groups continue their onward march below. But to understand the status quo, the origins of this deceptively named Gothic quarter are instructive. Urbanist and researcher Agustín Cocola-Gant, whose book The Invention of the Gothic Quarter suggests the fate of this tourist hotbed was preordained by planners, transports us back a century to a time when tourism wasn't such a taboo word.
The story of the Gothic Quarter in the 20th century is quite peculiar, because a big part of the neighborhood was recreated or reinvented, or we can say it was medievalized. So it was reconstructed following medieval shape, but a shape that it didn't have originally. So So it is the oldest part of the city, this is true, and there were a lot of medieval buildings in that area. But the truth is that between the 1920s and 50s, 60s, almost 40 buildings were recreated. Entire buildings, facades, windows, even buildings were moved stone by stone to the area and concentrated in that Gothic quarter. But even the name is an invention, a modern invention, because it was called the Cathedral Neighborhood, and the name was created in 1911. It was proposed by the local politician. In order to understand this recreation, we need to talk a bit about the history of tourism and how tourism was developing at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. Tourism was already a reality in Europe. You have Thomas Cook at the end of the 19th century. He already moved 2 million people to Europe. So it was an important industry. In 1908, Thomas Cook opened an office in Barcelona. And Barcelona was interested in attracting British visitors and other European visitors. And so also Barcelona created an organization to attract tourism and to organize the tourism industry in the city. And that organization influenced urban planning. If you read some journals in the 20s in Barcelona, they say our monuments and heritage are not displayed in the spectacular way that visitors want. So they have this vision already at the beginning of the 20th century. It's important to say that the origin of the Gothic Quarter was a top-down project implemented by the local authorities and the economic elites. In the construction of the Gothic neighborhood, a lot of housing were demolished. Poor people were evicted and they have to leave and move out from the neighborhood because obviously they wanted to display the monuments without poor housing around. Obviously there is a tension and a struggle between development or the needs of the local authorities and economic elites and the everyday needs of residents. And you can see it clearly today, what is going on in the city center of Barcelona, but I think that you can also see that in the past. Today we can't understand Barcelona without tourism, and this is, I'm talking about the present right now, but we also can't understand the history of Barcelona without tourism, and this is a really interesting point. We can take a lot of lessons from this case and for future tourist planning and city planning in other places. Obviously, if you liberalize everything in a city and you just promote growth and growth without control, what you get is this. Barcelona has a problem now and it's going to be very difficult to sort it out, but I think that in other places that wants to copy the model of Barcelona, because it's really famous around the world, I think that they should think about that and they should consider what they want for their places.
Rekindling history has had its share of successes too. In 1986, the city celebrated the reconstruction of Mies van der Rohe's Modernist Pavilion, which had been lost after Barcelona's 1929 World Fair. The striking marble and stone structure's second coming reappeared at a vibrant moment. Barcelona was gearing up for its transformative Olympics, and the city was awash with ideas and metamorphic energy. Sitting down with Ivan Blasi, who is the chief curator at the Mies van der Rohe Foundation and the coordinator of its prestigious European Prize for Contemporary Architecture, we are both reminded of how one rousing structure has the capacity to inspire an entire city.
For many years, the city had been willing to change and to improve. And so already in the 50s, during the dictatorship, there was Oriol Buigas who had the idea of reconstructing the pavilion. He asked Mies van der Rohe himself, and he received a positive answer from him, from his side. But that was not possible. This reconstruction was not possible until the dictatorship finished and then democracy was recovered. And so finally in 1986, it was finally built. And the city had had such an important building that had been discussed all over the world, but it did not exist. So the city thought that it was important that in such a case with this very important building, important for the city of Barcelona, important for the history of architecture and probably for history in general.
Ich kann mir nicht vorstellen, was ein Pavillon sein sollte.
So the city, through also the involvement, a very strong involvement of people in the city hall, and afterwards with Oriol Buigas himself being part of this city hall in the urban department, well, making it possible to rebuild the Barcelona pavilion, originally from 1929, but having it again in 1986. So that's one of the examples of how people from society, from the civil society, but also professors, architecture students, architects, and also philosophers, for example, and politicians were involved in a project to improve the city.
The pavilion itself kind of really served as a catalyst for kind of promoting and preserving Barcelona's design culture, didn't it? Especially at that time.
And this also helped in this internationalism, we could say, of the city of Barcelona, which had already received the news that it was going to organize the Olympic Games. And so this kind of possibility of improving the city and creating an image of the city and making it more visible to people from outside the city, but also thinking about those that lived in the city, so improving public spaces and so on, and also creating a series of cultural areas or buildings, was one of the most important aims, I would say, of that moment.
How active was the foundation in promoting design, promoting urbanism, promoting architecture around that time when it first emerged in the 80s and in that time of the Olympics?
The foundation wanted to rebuild the Barcelona Pavilion, but not then having it there just like a kind of empty or dead object, or an object as itself, but to have a series of events going on or a series of programs. So that's why it was very important that it created the European Union Prize for Contemporary Architecture, the Mies van der Rohe Award, also invited artists and architects from all over the world already then in the 90s to participate by thinking about the pavilion and transforming it. And this is something that continues nowadays. Also creating relationships with universities.
It's hard to quantify, like you said, the effect that it has had on the city, but it's interesting to think that one building has had such a huge impact or huge influence on the way Barcelona sees itself, but also the way that it understands design and architecture.
Something that was very important in the 90s, when people started really being liking their city, so we really kind of were proud of having a city such as Barcelona in which there were so many nice transformations. But what's really interesting as well is that the city of Barcelona, as far as we know from texts and so on, has always been very, very critical with what's happening. So one thing was being kind of proud, so this issue of pride, but at the same time criticizing very much what was being done and having opinions. So everybody seems to have an opinion and everybody seems to not want a series of things or want to do them somehow different. So discussions always are there, they are necessary, and at the same time, of course, there are no magic solutions. And what's also very important, and that's something that happened with the creation of the Mies van der Rohe Pavilion and the foundation and the creation of the Mies Award, is that there was this possibility of seeing what else was happening in Europe, and afterwards from Europe to the rest of the world, understanding the problems, and some of them which are very similar, and being able to exchange ideas, opinions, solutions. The there are still things which we can learn from there. And of course, there are also things that have happened in the city of Barcelona, which can also be valuable for other cities.
On the other side of the city, in the former textile factory-rich district of Poblenou, the impact of ideas, from grand inspirational blueprints to more minuscule independent initiatives, is illustrated across two generations. Javier Mariscal's studio, famed for designing Barcelona's beloved Olympic mascot Kobe, also championed the rebirth of Palo Alto, a factory complex-turned-creative hive. It's here that I meet with designer Pepin Mariscal and his entrepreneurial daughter Paula, whose contrasting perspectives of past and present seem to capture why more intangible forces are also essential when paving a path forward.
For Spain, Barcelona has always been a reference point. More avant-garde, more modern, more European, and even more professional than the rest of Spain. Before then, the dictator had us all submerged, black and white in black. It was as if the colours were forbidden. When Spain transitioned to democracy at the end of the 70s to the start of the 80s, the pressure cooker exploded because the dictator was dead. For me, this was the most beautiful moment. During these libertarian days, people used to frolic around nude in Park Güell. It was a crazy time. The spirit of freedom was such that our new political leaders just couldn't cope.
Los nuevos gobernantes no daban abasto. No podían.
Palo Alto is the last, the unique factory in Poblenou who is still having the same lines than in the beginning, when in the 20th century was a fabric factory. And the big change for this, and the big opportunity for this building, was that in the beginning of the 90s, my uncle, Javier Mariscal, decided to rebuild or reborn this abandoned building. Right now, it's like a hive of creativity, as you said, where different creators, designers, photographers, architects, they moved in here, their studios, and start to reborn that building that was completely dead.
It was a very lively city, which took advantage of its newfound freedom and this desire to put itself on the map. And that's how Barcelona positioned itself as a design city. This euphoria about design swirled together with something more festive and more colourful. Even Freddie Mercury came to sing with Cabaret. There was something magical about that, even the moment of lighting the Olympic flame with a bow and arrow. It was done flawlessly.
Salió bien por fin, ¿no? Lo de la llama olímpica. Y es el hito.
The milestone of being able to capitalize all of that energy, all that euphoria, all that optimism, which came from the post-dictator era and the transition, can be accredited to one man. This man, with his mind, capacity for seduction and storytelling, was Maragall, the best mayor that Barcelona ever had, and dare I say, in all of Spain. With a unifying idea of the Olympics, he was able to convince the city to put Barcelona on the map. The revival of Poblenou, as the neighbourhood, has its origins here.
La recuperación de Poblenou, de hecho, como nuevo barrio.
Well, Poblenou, I think that right now is one of the most interesting neighborhoods in Barcelona. There are some big things that are happening in the neighborhood that helps to conform this spirit of creativity or culture. 50 years ago was impossible to imagine. I mean, Poblenou was just an industrial area, and there are only factories. In the 90s, they decide, and because of this, they put the name Palo Alto as the hive of creativity. And if we want to do something more in Palo Alto, we need to be strong as them.
Yo creo que esto es obvio, ¿no? Todas las ciudades.
All cities of the world, or at least all of the big ones, need a grand plan, an idea, a project that propels them towards the future. These days there is much talk of changing the paradigm and of new challenges. But it's evident, and I don't know how much longer I will live, but in the 21st century, and for the new generation, everything will change. This is obvious.
Para las nuevas generaciones va a cambiar todo para vosotros, ¿no? Es decir, es obvio.
I feel something very different between me and my father, and between the 80s or 90s in Barcelona and nowadays, no? I have the feeling that there are big difference between the past and the present, because I think that they really have like a vision of a city. I missed a little bit this kind of big idea, or so I think that maybe nowadays it's lacking an idea or something like a vision, no? To project us to the future and what we want to be, no?
El asunto es que en este momento Barcelona está.
The thing is that today Barcelona has become very ideologized by an issue that has more to do with Catalonia than with Barcelona specifically. Today there is not much discussion about the great challenges. Big ideas are being lost. Maybe this fear of uncertainty, sparked by a future that feels imminent, which is generating new nationalisms with a fear that is taking people backwards, instead of marching towards progress, to a better future.
I think that in Poblenou, really, it's happening something. I mean, I think that we are not working together, but we are working in the same way. But I think that it's very different to have like a common vision. Yeah, we can have it, a common spirit. And I think that the good part or the nice part of this is that we have a conviction on the importance of design, of culture, of have fun, of the professional way of doing things. I think that I'm optimistic. When we start to talk about it, it's complicated to be only optimistic. But I think that we have to be optimistic.
Tension between paradoxical forces have always added colour to daily life in Barcelona, and it should come as no surprise that the perennial pursuit of urban improvement has turned into a source of friction. As millions of tourists flood the city each year, residents are once again rallying together to reclaim their territory. This time, battles are being fought in food markets against creeping gentrification and against ever-rising rents. This incendiary spirit is a familiar one, but the city is also crying out for a more sanguine vision, and one that isn't confined to just a list of its ails. However, with such a proud spirit of solidarity fueling residents' flair for making themselves heard, the fire of conversation about the future is guaranteed to have plenty of spark. For Monocle in Barcelona, I'm Liam Aldous.
A report there by our man in the region, Liam Aldous. And remember, you can find the full story on Barcelona and 19 other cities, and much more besides, in our brand new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities, which is available in all good bookstores now, and of course, at monocle.com. It's a book of inspiration for anyone who cares about making better cities for work, life, and play. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, Monocle 24's very talented team of editors. Well, to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's George Ezra with, well, you've guessed it, Barcelona. Thank you for listening, city lovers. Barcelona.
still long to hold her once more. Oh, my boots of leather from Europe, I gather, you know. No. Every time you have been.